This is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
Direct from the NYU Langone Medical Center, Doctor Radio. Here are Doctors Dolores Malaspina and Michael Aronoff.
And this is the Psychiatry Show here on Doctor Radio on Sirius 114 and XM 119. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff, and my co-host is Dr. Dolores Malaspina, and we're back together after I was away for, you know.
Yeah, welcome my
fault,
back.
My fault.
Welcome back from the foothills of the Himalayas.
I was in India for a little over 2 weeks doing some, well, we can talk about that later.
Okay.
It was fascinating. It is a very, very interesting country filled with interest, culture, conflict, chaos, and some wonderful people as well.
And beauty.
Both physical, natural physical, and man-made physical, with a mixture of religions that is, we ought to talk about that a little bit, because it is so interesting how these various people get along and get together. Just let me mention one thing about the chaos there. The traffic, you know, if you have a three-lane highway, in India there is no three-lane highway. Even though it's a three-lane highway, it's an eight-lane highway. Cars are coming at you from every different direction. I was thinking, as I was caught up in one of those traffic jams, if this were to happen in New York City, there would be fights, there would be murders, there would be whatever. In India, it's not that. It's not the case. Now, you can rationalize and say, well, maybe it's a kind of Eastern or Hindu or even Muslim or some sort of religious background that says that, hey, this is our lot in life. We are going to live with it, and we are going to be together, and we are going to reach out to our neighbor. Well, they reach out in certain ways, but, you know, these traffic jams are horrendous. I am telling you that things come to a complete halt with smog and so forth. This is in the cities. In the countryside, it's a little bit different.
One can only wonder about the religious underpinnings of staying in your own highway lane.
There's got to be some sort of religious dictum about that. In any case, we are talking on the Psychiatry Show, and as we do every week when we're both here and when we're here separately and whatever, we talk about anything having to do with human behavior. We talk about things in terms of the current status of treatment of various treatment and diagnosis of various psychiatric disorders, and also try to address questions and areas of interest in the current news as to how they relate, how particular events may relate to human behavior, why people do what they do, and what we as psychiatrists can bring to an understanding of human behavior. Today, for the first hour, we're going to talk about, a series of disorders, social anxiety, dyslexia, ADD. They are sometimes interwoven. They are sometimes interconnected. It is sometimes raised that, you know, well, are we overdiagnosing these things? Well, from my point of view, I don't know how you feel about this, Dolores, but what's changed in society is not that we're overdiagnosing. It's not that we are overdiagnosing either situations or pathology, but with increased education, knowledge, and communication, we become more aware of certain aspects of human behavior that really do have both biological and psychological underpinnings that really are disease processes. And although we talk about it now more as a disease process, it doesn't mean that it didn't exist before. We just didn't know how to think about it.
Yeah, and I think we appreciate now how many medical diseases are interwoven with psychiatric and behavioral diseases. We also see the onset of diseases like depression at younger and younger ages. And it's possible that there really is more disease, more mental suffering, Michael.
But it's also possible that what previously existed was there in any case, and it was going on unrecognized. It was treated as bad behavior or a bad kid instead of appreciating the fact that this was an early onset of depression, for instance.
Yeah. Well, your view is so much more hopeful that these things, we can identify them, we can treat them, people can get well.
Well, that's what we're trying to do in any case. So let's introduce for this first hour. By the way, our second hour, we're going to open the phones. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about within the psychiatric, psychological realm that we're capable of talking about. I guess we're capable of talking about any of this stuff, right?
Yes, Dolores? Yes.
For this first hour, we are going to be joined by Dr. Harold Levinson. He's a board-certified psychiatrist and neurologist as well as an author and researcher. He's the director of the Medical Dyslexic Treatment Center in Great Neck, New York. He began his research well over 35 years ago within the New York City Board of Education and was formerly here at the NYU Langone Medical Center as a clinical associate professor of psychiatry. He has a recently updated book. It is entitled Smart But Feeling Dumb, New Understanding and Dramatic Treatment for Dyslexia. So welcome to our program, Dr. Harold Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Harold, can we go by first names? I'm Michael, sure. And Dolores is Dolores, or sometimes we switch, but still first names.
Welcome, Harold. It's nice to have you on the show today.
Thanks again. I enjoyed your trip to the Himalayas. Before you mentioned the three-lane highways, I thought you were talking about New York.
I know, but the thing is that there in India, this chaos happens, the 3-into-8-lane highways happens, but there are no arguments, there are no fights or anything. Of course, it's intermixed with camels, cows, literally everything that you've heard about India or seen in pictures, by the way, is true, just magnified by about 30. The other thing is, just as I might mention as a side, Harold, I'm sure you've seen pictures of the Taj Mahal.
Uh-huh.
To see it in person, you can't imagine. It is breathtaking. It is beautiful in pictures. It is absolutely breathtaking in person. It takes, it transports you. In any case, we're going to, Dolores and I will talk about that later.
I basically think that also ties in with what both of you were saying, that when you have a global view of something, such as emotional difficulties and whatever, it's not the same as treating people firsthand, head-on, over and over again. You get a much clearer picture, much clearer appreciation for what you're looking at. And
I agree. I did have the opportunity when I was in India to speak with a number of different psychiatrists, primarily in Delhi and in a town called Jaipur, town of 3 million. It happens to be the capital of the state of Rajasthan, which is in the northwest section of India. But I had a chance to talk with them because I was particularly interested in post-traumatic stress disorder. This recently having been the one-year anniversary of the Mumbai attacks. So a lot of focus was on that. And it's very interesting to hear from the Indian psychiatrist's point of view because they're dealing with things that we have dealt with in this country still are in terms of stigma associated with psychiatric care and treatment. And their approach to post-traumatic stress disorder, if I can just go off on a little bit of a tangent, is that they use medication to engage. And then once they've engaged, then they are able to sort out who among the people that they've treated may be open to, conducive to talk therapy and dealing with the loss or the trauma that they have experienced. But it's a very interesting just formulation of the use of medication as an adjunctive tool to get you into psychotherapy. Now, I don't know how that translates into what we're going to talk about with you, Harold, about dyslexia, ADD, social phobia, and so forth. But tell us a little.
I think you hit it on the head, actually.
I did?
Yes.
Let me just say,
what
I'm 10
guest.
And a half.
What a good guest, Harold.
Harold, you're welcome back anytime. In fact, let's stay on for hours and hours. I'm a 10 and a half.
You'll see exactly that I wasn't even complimenting you. I was stating it as an exact fact that as my experience, I was trained as a psychoanalyst, so obviously we sort things psychologically first.
Right.
And medication at that time was poo-pooed, you know. And I've come full swing around, not completely, but where appropriate. And I find, just like in severe depression, you can't engage somebody unless you get them to be able to be responsive.
Right.
If they're out of their depression. So you got to treat them medically first so they can talk.
If somebody won't sit still, they can't listen and work on the psychological problems that are necessary to
Exactly.
Dyslexia, ADD, social phobia, where do you want to start?
Well, let me basically give people an idea of where my research started from.
Great.
Brief history, and I think the sequence will follow your trip to India and what we're saying very, very clearly.
Great.
I started out as a psychiatrist for the Board of Education almost 40 years ago. And at that time, they thought dyslexia or learning problems were psychologically caused within the Board of Education. I was trained as a Freudian psychoanalyst and psychiatrist and neurologist, and I had no quarrel with it, except when you saw face-to-face, like in the ear, rather than looking at it from a picture or a book, you began to see that the pieces you were taught didn't fit exactly. You had severe cases of reading problems coming from the best schools and the best homes, and you had the worst cases that came from great schools and great families and great teaching. So you realized that psychological factors and sociological factors alone could not determine the difficulties, nor could they explain the quality of the symptoms, the reversals like B and D that you saw with many of the individuals that had learning problems. And I then switched to the neurological idea, which said that there was a disturbance within the thinking brain. There was a process, a reading processor that was impaired. And when adults had an injury to this, they completely lost the ability to read. It was called alexia. Well, these children that I began to see didn't seem to fit the alexia model either, because many of them were very bright and gifted. The individuals who lost the ability to read as a result of a trauma lost their IQ as well and had a poor prognosis, whereas we all know that Einstein, Edison, Da Vinci all had dyslexia and many, many more, so that they were gifted. And you can't have brain damage and be thinking brain damage and have that kind of giftedness
in show. In part, Harold, isn't it true that, I mean, part of the common myth, not that it's not true, about dyslexia is that sometimes the smartest people are dyslexic?
Yes, but those are the ones we focus on. And it turns out, interestingly enough, that you can be retarded and be dyslexic at the same time as well. That was not known because we were thinking of it as a pure diagnosis in its severest, purest form. So the initial diagnosis of dyslexia is you had to be severe reading impaired, two or more years behind your peers. It was sort of like diagnosing diabetes as a comatose state, not recognizing that there were shades of gray. Mm-hmm. But as I began to see thousands of cases, and I began, as a psychiatrist, asking them why they had the problem they had, what difficulties were they experiencing, they began to tell me that they had difficulty tracking, they lost their place, they needed a finger or a marker when they read, the words got blurry, they doubled up, they wiggled on the page. Some said they had like a tunnel vision, they saw only one letter at a time, and they had to piece together each letter and say, a B, A, T, bat. And some of them couldn't read when there were too many words on a page. The words would scramble together, whereas they could read the word on a page alone. And some actually, so they had, and many had memory problems. They could read, and they could learn it, and they would forget it again. So the idea that it was a concept problem turned out to be completely wrong. It was an orientation problem. It was a tracking problem. It was, as I said, memory was significantly impaired. It was a visual processing problem, an auditory processing problem. Many of them could see the letter and could read visually, but they couldn't sound out the letters and words. Some could sound out the letters and words, all right, but they couldn't remember the visual form. So you had a whole slew of combinations of mechanisms all contributing and shaping the final reading disorder. But it wasn't just a reading disorder. When you examined hundreds of cases, writing and spelling and math and memory were impaired as well, but the original reading processor theory only took care of the reading. So that if you had brain processes impaired, one for each of the reading and writing and spelling and math and memory and speech symptoms, you'd have to have an IQ of minus 2,000. You couldn't focus on the bright dyslexics. There wouldn't be any. And the other aspect of the definition is that you had to be of normal intelligence to be dyslexic, and you couldn't have anything wrong with you. What they did is they thought a theoretical concept to eliminate all the other variables that could theoretically contributes to a reading problem.
Mm.
What, there's no such animal that doesn't have psychological problems, emotional problems, cultural problems, and God knows what else wrong with you.
Let me just remind our audience that you're listening to The Psychiatry Show. Our guest is Dr. Harold Levinson, the author of a revised and updated book entitled Smart But Feeling Dumb. We are talking initially about dyslexia, but we are also considering ADD as well as social phobias. And we're going to talk about all of those. We welcome your phone calls, 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. Or you can email us a question at docs@sirius-radio.com. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff, and with me, as always, by my side, by her side, is Dr. Dolores Malaspina. So, Harold, what is the current definition of dyslexia? And I assume we ought to address some of this information to parents specifically in terms of what should they be looking for, or if they are concerned about something, how they organize their concern.
Okay. May I just finish, and then I'll get to
absolutely.
That. Okay, because I just want to finish the trend, and then
absolutely.
I'm almost
sure.
There. I know that it's taken a long time. In any event, it was thought to be a thinking brain problem. I couldn't find anything wrong with the thinking brain, as nor could anybody else. And when I examined them, I found difficulty with balance, coordination, and rhythm. They were late talkers, late walkers, late crawlers by history. They had difficulty in their history with fine, gross, and rhythmic motor coordination. They may have speech articulation problems, enunciation problems. This was thought to be a language problem. It was a motor problem. And they had balance problems, accident proneness, tripping, falling, bumping. And lo and behold, I found that in examining them closely, once I found there were balance and coordination problems, I said to myself, maybe there's a problem within their inner ear and the cerebellum. This is why they all, invariably, when you were looking for it, had some difficulty with balance, coordination, and rhythm. And I then said to myself, how can a balance, coordination, and rhythmic problem affect input? And I devised a concept that was very, very simple, that the inner ear and cerebellum act as a fine tuner. They fine-tune all sensory signals coming into the brain, visual, auditory, proprioception, namely knowing where your body parts are in space. And they affect speech coordination as well, and balance and coordination. So that if there's a channel that's scrambled that goes to a normal thinking brain, that particular channel of information will be impaired. So that one simple problem that has nothing to do with IQ can affect hundreds of different symptoms, including concentration, memory, and whatnot. And it turned out that the symptoms of dyslexia affect not just reading, but writing, spelling, math, memory, speech, sense of direction and time, grammar. Concentration and distractibility, or what's known as ADD and activity level, are overlapping 95% of the time. Many have mood and anxiety symptoms, but initially we thought the anxiety was secondary to the frustration that these individuals have. And as I said, there's a whole slew of psychosomatic symptoms, headaches, dizziness, nausea, motion sickness, that are part and parcel of this syndrome very, very often. And it turns out that I said, what if we treated them with anti-motion sickness antihistamines? Would the reading improve? And lo and behold, not only did the reading improve, but after a number of years of perfecting the treatment, it turned out that the medication not only improved the reading, but as patients said, my reading not only improved, but my writing and spelling, but my sports. I can now play sports better. And we got a better appreciation for the depth to which this disorder really affected not just the neurological an academic part of the problem, but individuals said, I no longer feel stupid, or I feel like I have a brain now. And so,
I think it's really interesting and important for our audience to know that these conditions in psychiatry are heterogeneous, by which I mean that you can have some symptoms that can be common for many different brain disorders. And I guess, Harold, as well, that you're talking about some pool of people who have this overlap and cerebellar problem. I know there's some genetic studies now have narrowed down specific genes to other particular aspects of dyslexia. So you wouldn't think that this would be true for all of dyslexia.
Right, that there may be different subgroups of dyslexics.
So I thought initially, let me tell you where I've come 35,000 cases later. And so I assumed that there were, I called this dysmetric dyslexia in my first paper in 1973, assuming there were other causes of reading problems in bright and normal individuals. And in treating individuals with medications that improve the inner ear, it turns out that adults as well as children suddenly said, I'm no longer afraid of heights or elevators or escalators, trains, planes, buses. And I suddenly realized that there's a phobia for every form of motion. Now, this could be an accident, but it turns out one of the most brilliant psychoanalysts, Otto Fenichel, in a book in 1946, recognized that vehicle phobias, travel phobias, height phobias are related also to motion sickness, and he attributed it to a sexualization of the inner ear.
Well, I would think one thing that would be particularly useful would be to see how this relates to social anxiety and social phobia, because we have the holidays coming up now.
Yes, and I'll get to that as well. So once we got an idea that it can affect phobias and height phobias, there's obviously balance has to do with height. Now, it turns out that social phobias also disappeared. And when I asked them, first, I didn't even know they had social phobias. I was treating them for dyslexia and ADD. And I said, well, what happens when you go to a party? Well, some of them would say, the crowd, it's too much. I can't think. Well, they were overloaded. They had too much visual input, too much sound input, very much like the dyslexic who can't read when there are too many words on a page or can't do arithmetic if there are too many examples on a page. But if you isolate them, one example per page, they can do it very, very clearly. They can't separate foreground from background, and the pattern merges. So also when there's a crowd, it doesn't have to be people. It could be figures. It could be symbols, but it could be people, and in people it's social.
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of these things have to do with arousal, and under a setting of too much stimulation and too much arousal, some lucky people improve their cognitive capacity, but I think most people have a deterioration.
Yeah,
they disorganize.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the whole idea of self-regulation is interesting here, Harold, as well. It's been a big movement and an appreciation that some people don't learn self-regulation skills when even they're tiny infants, and how that can stay and really haunt them later in their life.
Excuse me, but it's easier to learn it if you decide this, if you have the mechanisms that you can focus on a different. Many of them don't realize what it is. They just become anxious and don't like it. They just overload it and want to get out, you know, or just feel uncomfortable or confused.
Well, why don't you give us an example? So how does dyslexia, for example, end up causing social anxiety?
Well, I'm saying if you're in a social situation and there's too much crowding, overloading, that could be one mechanism. And another mechanism, if you're in a party and there's too much sound, the noise, they have difficulty blocking out background noise. So when they're talking to somebody, the background noise confuses foreground conversation, and they can't understand what the other person's saying, and they have difficulty responding.
Harold, this sounds a little bit like then it's overlapping with ADD. That is, the attention gets diffused.
Yes. Many of them, for example, have speech articulation enunciation problem and Freudian slips of the tongue, which is characteristic of dyslexics. They have trouble remembering the words they want to say, the thoughts they want to say.
You know, a lot
and
of kids,
many
these
of them say the wrong word, the opposite of what they intend to say, and when they're disorganized by a background crowd or background noise, the Freudian slips start to intensify their anxiety that they're looking stupid and acting dumb.
Right.
Intensifies, and they want to get out.
I understand the basis of your theorizing about this, and it's an interesting thought. However, What about parents who are faced with a child who's not reading in class? How should they go about evaluating this? Let's assume that they have been checked out neurologically, and grossly, there are no problems neurologically. How should a parent begin to think about whether this is a reading problem, whether this is an attentional problem, what the overlap is, the anxiety that then is engendered in the child and then further interferes, you know, and complicates the picture? How should they approach it, from your clinical experience?
Well, I've written Smart But Feeling Dumb for several reasons, one of which is that parents can read it. And what I have is a self-help test right off the bat. I find that the quality of the symptoms define whether the symptoms are physiological very often as at its origin. In other words, let's say we take reading. You know, if the reading, for example, if the words get blurry, double up, wiggle on the page, if children complain of this, if children, when they read, lose their place, they have to slow up their reading, they need a finger or marker to fixate, they have focusing problems or tracking problems, they have, which also results in blurring and double vision. As I said before, if children say that they can't read when there's too much on a page, they get confused, but they can only read when there's just a few words on a page, that is not a psychological problem, that's a physiological overloading problem. Also, if they reverse letters like B and D and was and saw and insert words that don't belong and leave out words that aren't there, again, that's a physiological problem having to do with dyslexia.
You know, a lot of kids are given this diagnosis these days, which was uncommon years ago, a sensory integration problems. And I wonder, you know, would you see this new diagnosis of young children and sensory integration as tapping a little bit into your concept, Harold?
It's the same thing. But what they were doing is, if you look at the vision alone, they'll say it's a visual processing problem. If you look at from the auditory point of view, when they have auditory delays and auditory processing problems, they'll call it an auditory processing problem. What they're doing is they're labeling different aspects of the whole problem by different names, and parents get confused, not recognizing that these are sub-aspects of one whole disorder. Like, take a diabetic. You look at the skin problems and call it by one name. You look at the cardiac problems, you call it by another name. You look at the peripheral vascular problems, you call it by a different name. And on. So you have hundreds of different symptoms, hundreds of different disorders, and if you didn't have a wide enough concept of it all being related to a primary insulin deficiency that radiates out and changes shape and form when it hits different targets, the skin, the heart, the legs, the eyes, so that the same is true with the dyslexic panorama, I call it.
Okay.
It's really a hologram. And when you understand it, you realize not only does it cause psychological problems secondarily, but indeed there's primary anxieties that result from this problem as well.
Well, that's what I want to get to, and that is that, you know, sometimes a problem starts, it's fed by one particular source, and then it takes on a life of its own and accumulates other kinds of problems, which then become fixed in their own way. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, Harold, if we can, I'd like to talk about social anxiety, which can very much be a consequence of this, and how we recognize it and what we do about it, if that's all right with you as a direction to pursue.
Sure.
Okay, great. We're going to take a break. You're listening to The Psychiatry Show here on Dr. Radio. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff with Dr. Dolores Malaspina, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Dr. Radio, Sirius 114, XM 119, and on the Sirius XM iPhone app.
You should never, ever give up. That's part of the reason that we talk about what we talk about on the show, the psychiatry show here on Dr. Radio. We welcome your calls, 1-877-698-3627, 1-877-NYU-DOCS, or email us at docs@sirius-radio.com. We're heard every Tuesday from noon to 2 Eastern Time, and we talk about all things psychiatric and psychological. And today we are talking with Dr. Harold Levinson. He's on the phone with us about his studies and his recently revised and updated book, Smart But Feeling Dumb, New Understanding and Dramatic Treatment for Dyslexia. It is a broader issue that he deals with in his clinical practice. That is, it has to do with phobias, social phobias, ADD as well. And we are now approaching the holiday season. And with the holiday season comes, for many people, anxiety. The anxiety can take many different forms. It can be fueled by many different things. It can be fueled by one's discomfort, shyness when dealing with social situations. It can be fueled by the stress of the moment. But the question I would like for us to address, Harold, if we can, is with social anxiety, with the increased pressure of demands on people these days, practical solutions to what they should do and how to handle different kinds of situations that you run into in your clinical practice. Somebody says, you know what, I can't stand going to parties. You know, the issue about having to deal with the various people visiting, I feel overwhelmed. We were talking in the first half hour about how this feeling of overwhelm can be related to certain neurological changes that you have hypothesized are operating in the brain and can affect how somebody reads, how somebody reacts and interacts with other people. But let's see if we can focus specifically on social phobia. Particular thoughts about that?
Yeah. You know, in social phobias, again, let me start out with the whole aspect. One is getting to the party or getting to
Good.
The holiday.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Some people are most anxious about getting there. Once they're there, they're fine. They're afraid of traveling. They're afraid of cars or trains or planes and new places or new situations or new circumstances. So that's the onset for some individuals. Once they're there, they're fine. They just can't get there.
And I think it's really important to point out that if people can push themselves to overcome that anxiety, it will get easier and easier and easier. So it is important that people recognize if that's a piece of the problem and make themselves function, would you say, Harold?
Definitely. That's why I'm trying to stick to mechanisms, because if we break the problem down into its separate parts and pieces, it's easier to deal with specifics than a global thing.
Yeah, so once you get to the point, then I think what some people have told me, another hurdle is that they don't always remember everybody's names.
Well, that's exactly, that's once they get to the party.
Yeah.
Once they get to the party, if they have a memory problem, memory, again, we're talking about young people and middle-aged people, we're not talking about seniors and super seniors, the memory problem is characteristic of dyslexia and ADHD and ADD. So the reason they have a memory problem, they don't have it just for other people's names, but they have difficulty, as I mentioned before, remembering the words they want to say, remembering the thoughts they want to say, remembering what other people have said to them. They just block it out. And if there are background noise and background distractions, the memory gets worse and worse, the forgetting gets worse and worse, the anxiety builds up.
So what can they do at a party, these people?
Well, believe it or not, when the noise is the biggest factor, I tell them to put in musical filters. You know, musicians wear filters that block out some of the sounds. I'm just talking about very practical things, and we'll get on to medical. And
so you mean like leave your earmuffs on?
Yeah, especially if it's cold.
Okay, there's a good excuse.
And filter. Sometimes it's flashing lights. If you go to a party where there's flickering lights, the flickering drives them crazy.
Put on sunglasses.
Exactly. Just as with other individuals, they're light sensitive, which is, again, an inner ear problem, and it drives them crazy. Sound, flickering can also drive people crazy. And believe it or not, they're children that are very sensitive to fluorescent lighting, the flickering. They can actually hear the flickering and see the flickering. That's how sensitive they are.
But don't you think it's important? Michael and I are both like jumping in. I mean, I think some of this falls into the realm of people needing to learn how to self-soothe, and there are many different aspects and ways that people can accomplish that. And it does, I agree with you, differ among individuals. But if you let the sensitivity to stimuli keep you home, you'll never learn how to self-soothe and modulate it.
I agree with you 100%. So there's no question. As I mentioned the individual mechanisms, you're coming up with everyday common sense, logical, and medical solutions. So as we said, memory and forgetting words, forgetting anxiety, some people have difficulty, for example, interacting and transitioning from one person to another in a party.
Well, let me ask you something, Harold, with regard to that. It's a very common experience for many people to be nervous about, well, when I go to this party, I'm not going to remember their names, and then they freeze in some way. What would you, what would you suggest? How should they approach this?
Well, there are several things. One, psychologically, I tell them, I delineate, just as I'm trying to do now, the different mechanisms that they personally, each individual that comes to me for a social anxiety, I try to find out, is it before getting to the party, what mechanisms are impaired, getting to the party, what mechanisms are impaired, and then the host also has to make the party, and they have social anxieties. They have, sometimes they're disorganized. They forget to put things on the table, and they anticipate becoming anxious. So we're dealing about not only the people that have to go to the party, but the people that have to make the party. They also have memory problems, disorganizing problems, and they have difficulty with time, and
panic.
So what I do is I break them down. I break down the different mechanisms, and then once we focus individuals on the different fears within social phobias that they particularly have, it makes it easier for them to recognize. Once they know, for example, that it's their memory, sometimes they don't even know it. Sometimes it's just that they get anxious and they blame it on the anxiety, and I tell them, when you get anxious, things get worse for some individuals. So just like people going into a test, the more anxious they are, the more they forget. The mind blanks out, and they become panic-stricken.
So in this kind of simple example that we're talking about, then, would you recommend to someone that write down the people's names as you're meeting them in the party?
Definitely. Know who you're going to be there, who's going to be there. Know, for example, who you might want to associate that's going to be there, and write it down. And the other thing is to bring somebody with you. Let's say if it's me, I'll bring my wife, who has a great memory for names. And she'll then step in, and once that hurdle is over, the rest of the party can be enjoyed.
You know, that I sometimes have that problem, so maybe that's a good solution for me. When I go to a party, I'll bring your wife, too.
No. It's fine. She loves partying. She loves partying.
No, but I think that this is practical and important advice. I think that that sometimes it's better to approach someone with a very specific problem. I think you have an interesting framework, Harold, but to an individual, I think it can sound like it's catastrophizing.
Because you're tying so many things together,
whereas if someone has an isolated problem, my tendency is to more want to focus very pragmatically on that, even though your framework rings true.
Yeah.
Well, again, we're talking about practical solutions, and we're coming up with them as we're discussing it. You can be more practical about some things even than I am, and I, you know, knowing the mechanisms, have mnemonics, so that if you're forgetting names and you have a party list, I mean, of course, you have people crashing parties even at
the White House.
So you have guests you didn't expect. But assuming you basically know a certain number of the individuals that are key to you or close to you. By the way, I have patients who can't remember their wife's name and children's name. Bright people that are CEOs of companies. They can't. That's how bad the name forgetting can be.
Mm-hmm.
How embarrassing and humiliating. So. And once they get anxious and humiliating, it spreads to even people they do know and even things they do know. So the anxiety can spread from one simple thing right across the board.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting example, because I think that Dolores would agree as well that anxiety does have this effect. However, as psychiatrists and particularly psychoanalytically trained, if you forget your spouse's name, it's going to raise some question about the relationship, too, having nothing to do with the neurology underlying it. Don't
not,
you think?
Not as much as if you call your spouse another name.
That's true.
That's usually a worse problem.
I have to tell you, I went down that route for many, many years, and it turns out that the opposite is true. The ones that cheat know everybody's name very, very well.
Okay.
Because they practice.
They don't get nervous. They're called psychopaths. The ones that are anxious are the ones that are least likely to forget people's names. And I keep both things in mind. But when you forget your child's name and you're terribly embarrassed by it, and then they have difficulty also forgetting impersonal names, people that work for them, their secretary, their accountant. It turns out that it's not just personal but impersonal names, and it could be nouns.
Right.
Book. They can't remember the name book. What's that thing you read? You know. So that you begin to see that there's a pattern, and so the diagnostics become clearer as your framework becomes wider, and the questions you ask become more pertinent. But anyway. So we can get rid of sound. We can sort of get rid of names by having a prompter there,
right.
Like the president has a television prompter, and
right.
It focuses him. Well, you can have names written on your sleeve or your palm, or you can have a list or a menu or whatever and have key people's names. Usually they remember the faces, although I have individuals.
Well, you raise the issue about diagnostics, and I'd like to go to the phones. Susan from Arkansas, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you have a question that you want to ask Dr. Levinson?
Yes, I thought it was fascinating, his dissertation on the dysgraphia panorama. I have a son that has diagnosed with dysgraphia, ADHD, sensory integration disorder, the wide gamut that he explained. And if I understand correctly, is he telling me just to go give him an antihistamine? Is that going to alleviate some of the problems?
Okay, let me answer your question in the context of what we're talking about.
Okay.
As I said, an inner ear problem in the supercomputer, the cerebellum, is responsible for everything you have mentioned.
Cerebellum being part of the brain.
Part of the brain. It's the supercomputer for it. And it also controls many anxiety mechanisms, including those that contribute to social anxiety, as do psychological mechanisms. Now, what I recommend in my book, Smart But Feeling Dumb, what I tell my patients and what I do in my practice is every individual has to be diagnosed. You have to be psychologically diagnosed and evaluated and neurologically diagnosed and evaluated. If it turns out that your problem is inner ear and cerebellum, and if the social mechanisms turn out to be related to it, I find that simple anti-motion sickness antihistamines can help a significant number of patients with anxiety that are similar to those that I mentioned. Now, sometimes medications, if the social anxiety is severe, as many, some people are immobilized by it, and it spreads to other areas of their life, as it sometimes does, you need other medications and other anti-anxiety medications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important.
In nature.
He doesn't
so
have
that you
the
need
social
a medical, you need a medical psychological diagnosis. You
yeah.
can't.
Okay, we've had the medical, we've had the psychological. How are you going to find out if it's an inner ear? ENT?
Well, you need a special ear, nose, and throat doctor. They're called neuro-otologists. They specialize in the inner ear, and they have special balance tests and eye tracking tests called electronystagmography. And I do this routinely, and I've been doing it for 30, 35 years. So I'm one of these psychiatrists that became a neurologist, became a neuro-otologist, because I had to follow where my research led me to.
Is this all in your book?
Yes, it's all in my book, and individuals that are interested could read what these mechanisms are, what the diagnostics are, and what the treatment methods are.
Well, I'm looking
works.
For the book today. I will pick it up because he has all the motion sickness. He gets everything, just like you're talking about.
Great.
So I'm
to give that. Now, it's important, I guess, for us to say that this is an off-label use of this drug. So, it's not approved for it. But I think going through your doctor and reviewing this would be wonderful opportunity for you to try this out. And the book is Smart But Feeling Dumb, New Understanding and Dramatic Treatment for Dyslexia by Dr. Harold N. Levinson.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Thank Susan. You. Thank you for the call. So the practical questions that people have, Harold, when they are faced with this with a child in terms of what do I do when this kid has all sorts of issues that sound like they're imbalance of attention, imbalance of ability to perform in school and so forth. What's the best way of approaching an evaluation of a child?
Well, as I said, understanding. So just like the woman who's on the phone, when she got on, she listened and understood everything I said. She could identify it with the child, which is not surprising because that's where the information came from. I didn't learn it any other way except by sitting down and talking with thousands of children and parents describing individuals they know or had this problem. And so what I have in the book is a self-diagnostic test. You can read the symptoms, read all that she experienced, and if there's sufficient identification, then you can go on and read up on the case histories. There are scores of case histories that describe the symptoms, including the reading, the writing, the concentration, the distractibility, and the anxiety symptoms, social and otherwise. If all of this fits, then I go into the treatment modalities, what medications and different types of medications work, and some practical method similar to what I described here.
Yeah.
Now, nobody should treat themselves, obviously, and individuals should consult pertinent doctors and bring the content to them. Now, the neuro-otologists, the special inner ear experts, are the leading individuals that know about the inner ear the most. They may not know so much about the anxiety symptoms and the reading and the writing, but they understand what the inner ear and the supercomputer, the cerebellum, the part of the brain, does. And so they could advise them. Sometimes a pediatrician or that they take the children will consult with me. And so individuals that are distant can consult with me, and we can have then the pediatrician monitor a treatment plan, if necessary, that's local. Sometimes it's a psychiatrist or psychologist that's local. If the child happens to be in psychiatric or psychological treatment. Sometimes the psychological treatment or the psychiatric symptoms are the predominant symptom. And then the other symptoms are there, but they didn't bring the child for the reading and the writing and the concentration. So that the reason I'm trying to link them all is you have overlappings. And the leading symptom determines where the child goes. If the speech problem is the leading symptom, they'll wind up with a speech therapist.
Yeah.
If the hearing symptom or the auditory processing, they'll wind up with a language therapist or a speech therapist. If the visual symptoms are most prominent, they'll wind up with an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. And psychosomatic symptoms like headaches, dizziness, motion sickness, feeling off balance, then those will go to neurologists and neuro-otologists and other specialists.
But the point being that a lot of these things can be interconnected,
yes,
and careful evaluation and diagnosis is absolutely essential for some sort of coherent treatment plan that can involve underlying biological systems as well as the psychological overlay.
You couldn't have said it better. I couldn't have said it better. And I think the reason and the best way, and the reason I wrote the book and tied all these things together is sometimes you have individuals that are going to four different people, four different experts,
right,
for four different sets of symptoms, but nobody has said maybe they're all interconnected. Maybe there's a common denominator, and somebody has to tie them all together, and maybe there's a treatment that can affect all four diagnosticians, so to speak, what they're doing, and complement them.
Harold, we're running out of time. I want to thank you for joining us and sharing with us the results, the fruit of your labor over 30-plus years. The book is entitled Smart But Feeling Dumb, New Understanding and Dramatic Treatment for Dyslexia. Again, Harold N. Levinson is the author and has been our guest. Harold, thank you so much for joining us.
I hope you enjoyed my Taj Mahal.
I did. We built many things together. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Harold.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You raised an interesting phrase before, and I think we ought to clarify that. You talked about off-label use of medication.
Yes.
Let's define that for the audience.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a system here where medications are approved for safety for a specific indication. Now, your medical doctor can use different medications other than what they've been approved for. That's an off-label use, and your doctor tells you the risks and benefits of that. For example, medicines like Dramamine or Benadryl, the antihistamines that we're discussing in the last hour, someone would want to be really careful about giving a trial of those to someone who might go out and drive a car, for example.
Sure.
So there are different risks and benefits, and those are pretty much standardized and examined when a medication is approved and on label, but they're less clear when a medication is not approved for a specific indication.
And yet, in clinical practice, sometimes you do cross some boundaries in terms of trying something that, on the basis of your clinical experience, you think may have not only an underlying rationale as to why it might be of help, but also it's worth trying because other things haven't worked.
Yeah, and I think that's how we make discoveries, Mike, because I think that doctors will frequently, for example, in psychiatry, psychiatrists had noticed that people who were being treated for epilepsy actually had an improvement in their mood. And so it was based on that clinical observation that the field went forward and discovered that many medicines for mood were originally developed to be medicines for seizures. So it's not incorrect that people do that, but it is important that a patient understand that difference.
Let's jump the gun for our next hour, where we're going to open the phones to whatever the questions are and go to Mike from Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and we got an expression out here. Sometimes you're the hammer, and sometimes you're the nail.
Okay.
And I thought you might find that humorous.
Yes.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, how does it apply to you, Mike?
Well,
which are you today as we're talking with you?
Today I'm the hammer. I'm having a good day.
Okay.
Just to touch on that, my topic is BPD, but I'm also bipolar. And I've been on Lamictal for a number of years, which was originally used for seizures, and it works out pretty good for me. So
that's
what
Dolores was talking about just before we put you on the air.
Yep, that's right. It's just a small world. But Dolores, I think, aren't you the one that's the expert with BPD? Behavioral personality disorder?
You mean dissociative personality disorder. Is that what you mean? What do you mean, DPD?
Behavioral? Personality disorder, BPD.
You don't mean a borderline personality disorder.
Oh, I'm sorry, duh.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yes, Dolores and I are both experts with regard to that.
Yeah, well, I guess so. Sometimes people who get a diagnosis of bipolar before they're treated have been called borderline. Did that happen to you?
No. My deal is I got hooked up with a woman who has borderline personality disorder, and it was the most amazing up and down crazy behavior relationship I've ever known.
But Mike, you understand that borderline personality disorder is not infectious. You didn't catch it from her.
No.
How were you able to recognize that? And I mean, sometimes you're in love with someone who has this problem and you can get help together and the relationship can work out. But other times people have to make a separation.
I'm going to interrupt the conversation right now because we're just about out of time. Mike, can you hold on?
I can sure hold on.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to open the phones for all you guys to join us with whatever questions you have.
Gals, too.
Yeah, guys, I'm using it in a non-sex, gender-related way.
I got it.
Okay. So stay tuned. You're listening to Dr. Radio. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff. And my person who keeps close tabs on me and corrects me when I often need it, all the time, for that matter, is Dolores Malaspina. And we'll be right back after a brief break here on The Psychiatry Show.
I should try to find a way to kind of sort of maybe work it out. Ooh, with some solitary thinking.